If I asked you to define a lovely day, an optimal day, a perfect day even, what does that look like to you? For me, it's any day where I can curl up with a book for a little bit, maybe hit the climbing gym, play with my dogs, hang out with my family. But if I did that every single day, it would eventually get hard to pay the bills. So you can't have perfection every day. How do you decide what the trade-offs are? Well, new research from the University of Pennsylvania in the US shows three big things are involved in people experiencing a better than average day. You'll learn more about them in a tick. But in a world where we're encouraged to optimize every inch of our lives, is a perfect day really something we should be striving for? Well, with me is Dr. Dot Dumuy, who is, get this, a time use epidemiologist from Adelaide University. Dot, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you. Good morning.
So what does this new research out of the US tell us about how to spend a better than average day?
Well, they've used data from time use surveys. So, you know, asking people in the population what they did in their previous day. And they've come up with three really important deciders on whether you had a good day or an average day. And the three things that they've found was that having time with family, that's really important in deciding whether what kind of day you have. Also, the time you spend socializing and communicating. Mm-hmm. Could be with family or anyone. And then also, this is a funny one, the travel time related to eating and drinking.
So, what? The travel time?
Yes. So how long you spend driving to somewhere where you're going to eat or drink rather than driving to work or, you know, to sport or something like that. Yeah.
That is so not what I thought you were going to say. I thought it was going to be like, I don't know, sleep or relaxing or something
like
that.
Really surprising in there. There are actually 20 things that are important and they're ranked from top to, you know, from 1 to 20. And sleep doesn't show up in there, which I'm really surprised about. The working is the fourth one. But so the first three I told you about, if you have more of time with family, more time socializing and more eating, that's like more likely to predict a better than average day. And the fourth one is working. It's really important, but if you do more working, it's likely to predict an average day, not a better than average day.
And what about exercise? Because that's one of the factors.
Yeah, it is there. What does it rank at? Number 12. Oh, that's the travel to exercise. No, it's number 17. Participating in sports, exercise and recreation. So it's quite low down.
Interesting. So I really need to be focusing on the amount of time I spend driving to and from restaurants.
But doing more exercise is predictive of a better than average day, which is nice. I'm in epidemiology, so we're interested in the health outcomes, not just whether you have a good day, it's whether it's a good day for your health. And we would say time spent in exercise and sport and physical activity is, you know, an important predictor of a good day for your health.
That's an interesting thing I wanted to ask you about. So this is research that was done at the University of Pennsylvania. You weren't involved in it. You're commenting on it from your field of expertise, which, as you say, is more in the epidemiology side of things. When you look at this research compared to other research that's been done in the past that tries to kind of model a good 24-hour period, what are you seeing here?
Yeah, it's not completely different to what we find. There are always common threads, right? We usually find that the time people spend being active and active at a higher intensity, so they're puffing, getting the heart rate up a little bit, that's super important for a whole range of health outcomes, you know, for physical outcomes, mental and social as well. So that, and they don't need a lot really of that kind of high intensity activity, but you do need to fit it in somehow. So, you know, even 10 minutes is better than none. Trying to aim for getting the 30 minutes a day.
You're listening
is the guideline, yeah.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm chatting with Dr. Dot Dumuy, who is a time use epidemiologist from Adelaide University, getting her take on some new research from the University of Pennsylvania that showed what turned an average day into a good day for people using time use data. And there are a couple of big things that are involved in people having a better than average day: time with family, time socializing, crazily time spent driving to and from the place where you're going to eat. Exercise is an important ingredient, as we're hearing Dot say. But I'd love to hear from you on what you try to fit into your day because you know it's going to give you a better day. My number's 1-300-225-576. Give me a call. Tell me about what turns an average day into a good day for you. 1-300-225-576. A couple of people texting me. The British comedian Bill Bailey once said, "The definition of a good day was having a cup of tea, a good conversation, and seeing a bird." Well, I'm 2 out of 3 for that already, so that's great. Drew says, "My great day is sitting in the sun fishing and listening to ABC radio." Oh, wait, that's what's happening. It's a great day. Well, someone else who has been paying close attention to this research and applying some of the findings in her life is Emma Joyce, a freelance journalist in Sydney. Emma, how are you rating today so far?
Oh, today is definitely average, I'm sorry to say, although this is a highlight.
Good, good. Nice save. What were some of the, you sort of basically tried to live a statistically good day based on this data that Dot outlined to us before. What were some of the rules you brought in over this experiment?
So one of the rules, a really strict rule, was no housework. And another one was no relaxing, which included no watching TV.
That sounds stressful.
It was stressful for me a little bit in the day to make sure that I didn't do either of those things. But it was part of the fabric of making sure that I could work up to 6 hours of paid work. Now, I had the opportunity to do that. That was easy for me to do, but I've got to say it wouldn't have been if I was if I needed to meet certain deadlines or if I needed to have lots of meetings that day or anything. So according to this data, it was about not working more than 6 hours a day. Also, up to 4 hours of exercise. I was never going to fit that in on any day, but like on this particular Thursday, I did manage to go for a walk, run, jog. I think witnesses would call it walking, for around an hour. And I genuinely did feel so much better. I saw birds. Bill Bailey was onto something there, but I didn't realize that was going to be such a highlight of my day until I was doing it. And I don't leave the house to walk for leisure often enough. So that's something that from trialing this good day, I want to try and incorporate in my week more often. It's not sustainable for me to do that every day. I don't really have enough control over my time to factor that in always. But one thing that caused me a lot of stress was actively socializing between 30 minutes and 2 hours. So no more than 2 hours. I wasn't allowed to spend 2 hours and 5 minutes with friends. It had to be between 30 minutes and 2 hours. And finding that on a weekday, I have a 3-year-old as well. So trying to find friends where I could hang out with my 3-year-old and them somewhere where everyone would be safe and everyone would be fed was tricky to coordinate in my day. But I would also say that being stressed throughout my day was kind of normal, but actually adding in all of these different factors did make me feel cumulatively at the end of the day, I was like, that was actually a better than average day. That was a good day. I felt great. I had spoken to friends, offloaded some worries with them. I'd ignored dirty dishes in my sink, even though that made my eyes twitch. I'm usually quite a tidy person. And I had worked and I enjoy working, but I had made sure that I capped it at 6 hours. And I was permitted to do that. And I also spent a lovely 90 minutes at the pub catching up with friends in the end. But I was exhausted, I've got to say. That was the other thing. In order to make my day really, really good, I had to focus on how I spent my time. I couldn't doom scroll. In the evening, I couldn't just switch on the TV and hope for an episode of Bluey to make parenting a bit easier in the evening. So it was something that I want to do in the future, but I know that I wouldn't be able to achieve it every day.
That's a really interesting insight. You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. Tony, you think a perfect day actually starts the night before.
Oh, for sure. Yes. Hello, Tegan. A good night's sleep. Wonderful. And last night happened to be one. It was lovely. And then a good walk around beautiful Shores Bay area of Ballina with my dog, which is just finished.
A good night's sleep and a walk around Ballina with a dog sounds like a beautiful start to the day, Tony. Thank you for the call. Nigel, you've got a quick tip to set yourself up for a perfect day too.
G'day, Tegan, and good morning to all the listeners. A perfect day for me is where I don't forget to go through my gratitude list first thing in the morning. So for me, what's a gratitude list? It could be just being grateful for simple things such as your health. Then you could go even deeper into that. Be grateful for your vision, your hearing, your ability to walk, you know, things that we take for granted. Then you want to go outside of that, beyond that, and be grateful for the relationships you have in your life. And normally my only daughter comes into play. I go, I'm so grateful for her and her health. And then I think about other loved ones. Mum and dad are still alive. I'm grateful for that. And then you can be grateful for the fact that you have a job and that you have an income and you have food on the table. And you spend 5 minutes, that's all it takes, first thing in the morning. You can meditate on it as well if you wish. And you just get out of bed with that extra skip in your step. And this is something I've only been doing for 6 months and I've never been happier. But when I forget to go through my gratitude list, maybe my day is not so perfect.
Nigel, you sound like such a happy person. That's such a beautiful insight that you've brought there. Dot, listening to the tips that those two people have brought forward and what Emma has described, how does that fit with your understanding of what this research is aiming for?
Yeah, that's amazing. It's wonderful to hear what the listeners are saying. And I completely agree. And the research agrees to the importance of sleep and also the physical activity. And in the context of that physical activity, not walking to work along like a major arterial road, but walking with the dog in a beautiful location, like that's what we find also for like many health indicators, that's a real positive. The gratefulness one, that, you know, we don't even measure that kind of thing in a lot of our surveys. So we would be more objective with how people spend their time. Like, are they sitting, sleeping, standing, exercising? But that's a really good point. Like, what are people doing when they're sitting or lying and thinking? And what, yeah, that kind of aspect is really interesting, and I don't think we've really thought about that.
You need to give Nigel a call and get him to talk you through that for a future research project, great. Maybe.
Yeah.
So, Emma.
Yeah, I'm sure lying there being grateful is better than lying there stressing about the day, right?
That's so true. Exactly. I guess it's the activity you're doing within that activity. And, Emma, I'm interested to pick up on sort of the amount of work it took for you to kind of shoehorn optimization into a day. And maybe what you tried to take from that, because that did not sound sustainable, especially leaving your dishes in the sink every day.
Oh, it absolutely wasn't. I mean, I had to prepare my partner in advance that I wasn't going to be doing any housework, just so that didn't escalate into some sort of mini drama in our lives.
Yeah, I'm having a good day, so you have to have a bad one.
Yeah, I can't live in dirty sheets or eat off dirty plates. I need to contribute to the household. And I think that I do actually think that does contribute to having a good day in my life anyway. It's a lot of it was also about novelty, I think. So I don't go for a walk by the water every day, but I did on this day. And that was something that made me recognize my surroundings. And maybe talking about that gratitude element of it, I could recognize that I was grateful for that moment in the moment. Otherwise, it might have been quite a mundane walk around the Oval that I'm very familiar with, and maybe I wouldn't have taken in my surroundings as much. But there was some element to it that could have caused me more stress, especially, I think, when we talk about optimizing our days and optimizing our lives. I think it feels only natural that we want to strive to have a good life and for elements about our lives to be better than they are. But if it is causing stress and anxiety, which, for example, today, I'm not going to achieve any of those things that I achieved on that day that I had a good day. it probably won't result in a very bad day either. Like, I will be quite happy and comfortable with the fact that I didn't reach out to friends and go to the pub with my child and we just ate at home. That will bring me a different sort of calmness and happiness as well. So I think if something is causing you stress and anxiety to have this pursuit of a good day every day, then you'd have to think about the trade-off.
Yeah, Dot, how can we balance this when you mentioned the data about what's good for our health, the sort of amounts of physical activity that we need, the sort of amount of sleep that we need, all of the health facets here. 24 hours is often not long enough to tick all of these boxes every day.
Yeah, that's true. And we're not robots. We can't say, you know, we're going to do this exact schedule every single day. And also, what's best for one person isn't best necessarily for another person. So, you know, these recommendations from this article are based on the population average, but there's a lot of variation, and also many different combinations of activities could produce just a good a day. So, you know, there's a lot of nuance and variation that the research doesn't really go into. And also, yeah, we have our life that we have to live, and there's non-negotiable things that we have to do that needs to happen and fit into those days. But there are a few, I think, ingredients that we can try to aim for and every day, and that would be to get some exercise. And a great way to do that is just to go outside. I mean, if you don't go outside, you're not going to see birds. So I think if you just spend time outside, just some time outside, you'll probably not do those things that are bad for your health or for your well-being, like scrolling on your phone or stewing on things that stress you out. I think going outside opens your horizons, and you might see birds, and it will, I'm sure having that outside time gives you a better day and gives you opportunity to do physical activity. Mm. But also, yeah, no, being able to talk to somebody, ensure that you know have, it's hard saying make sure you get enough sleep, because that can stress you out and then you won't sleep. But having some sort of routine with, you know, going to bed at a certain time and getting up at a certain time and trying to keep that constant as much as you can around daily life. Yeah.
Exercise, get enough sleep. You mentioned social media use before, and Emma sort of mentioned having to kind of stop that maybe default to sitting down and scrolling for a bit. What do we know about how much time we spend on social media and what that's doing for us?
Yeah, it's such a common use of time nowadays, and we actually don't have a lot of research on it because we're not that good at measuring how long people spend on social media. It's our research hasn't really caught up with this development that's happened, which is a huge shift in the world, like in how people use their time. In this Time You survey that these recommendations are from, actually don't have an item about social media. It gets lumped into using TV or computers for leisure. So they still don't have a way to measure social media time, but we know that it's increased exponentially. In a survey, the census that happens in South Australian schools, the social media use has tripled. So, and we know that it's the same for adults. I'm guilty of, you know, using a lot of social media, and it takes so much of your time. So then you have less time left in your day to do all the other things you have to do. Well, right? It sucks out so much time.
You're sending me some beautiful texts about this. Powering through jobs I've been putting off for ages, it says one person. Jill says, one thing that gives me a good day is appreciating nature or getting out into the garden. Forest bathing is something that I try and do every week. Linda says, anytime alone, 40 years married, 40 of those both sleeping, eating and working together, I really try hard to set time alone. And one says, brekkie beers. If your level of responsibility for the day allows for brekkie beers, it's a good day. Emma, is there anything that you've tried to incorporate daily since your experiment? It may or may not be brekkie beers.
It definitely can't be brachybeers. I feel like I have too many responsibilities. One of them being a three-year-old, but just that would just go down very badly in my household. Well, very, very briefly on the sleep thing, I would also say it's so interesting that that's not included because I've slept poorly for many years, as you could imagine. But it didn't impact how I felt about my day at all. One thing I have taken into my day is purely that being slightly more aware or intentional about how I'm spending it. So if I am going to go on social media, just really clocking in with myself, like, have I sat here for an hour? Because that's not going to make me feel good. And is it at the detriment of my health, for example, going outside or having a walk? So I'm just more aware of it. I'm more conscious. I haven't specifically picked an activity that I will do every day, but I have decided that throughout my week, I want to try and achieve one good day a week, which will happen for me more towards the end of the week because I need to work more than 6 hours a day at the front end of the week so that I can pay my bills, as you mentioned right at the top of this whole segment.
Well, Mari's called in. Mari, what's your formula for a great day?
Hi, thanks for listening. I've been really enjoying hearing what you're saying. Definitely some sunshine, some time in nature, some exercise, some good food, some company with people who I care about, but at the end of the day, more good things that have happened than of bad.
Mari, it feels like you might be the researchers behind that University of Pennsylvania study. You couldn't have summed it up better. Thank you so much for the call. And thank you, Dot and Emma, for sharing your insights as well. Dr. Dot Dumwe is a time use epidemiologist from Adelaide University. Emma Joyce is a freelance journalist who experimented with new rules around what constitutes a good day. And thank you for your texts as well. Yvonne has sent a photo of what looks like her on an e-bike saying, "This is what makes my day better. The exercise, the farm fresh air, talking to neighbours, so much fun, produces endorphins galore." Well, you are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, there is a 50-50 chance that you have a dog as part of your household, speaking of things that bring joy. But where do you draw the line on pups in public spaces?
Smarten up your afternoons on ABC Radio National each weekday at 1:30.
On Mondays, it's The Science Show.
Every Tuesday, I ask, what the duck?
Science fiction on Wednesdays.
All in the Mind on Thursdays.
Then on Fridays, what's that rash?
And lab notes.
You bring the lunch?
We'll bring the science.
We'll bring the science.
1:30 weekdays, right here on ABC Radio National.
Do you have a dog in your life? Are they a pet? Maybe they're even an employee? Or do you think of them as a member of your family? Australians are keen animal lovers. 73% of households have some sort of pet. Almost half of us have a dog in the home. And since the pandemic, we've really embraced pet ownership. The shift towards working from home meant a lot of us got really used to spending a lot of time with our pets, and they got used to being with us all the time. Now lots of us are looking for more ways to do that outside the house, like taking dogs to the pub or to work. And if you're a dog person, you might be all for that, but not everyone's on board. And in councils across the country, there are ongoing tussles about where you should be allowed to bring a pet along with you and where you shouldn't. With me is Stuart Martin, behind a campaign to change Queensland's food standards legislation to allow dogs inside the suburban brewery he runs in Brisbane. Stuart, welcome to Life Matters.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you love your dog so much that you named your brewery after him. What's the name of the brewery, the dog, please?
Archer and Archer Brewing. So he is the namesake of the brewery.
But you had to kick him out of the pub after a complaint. What happened there?
One individual came down and I don't think they were surprised to see dogs in the venue and put a complaint into council, and we were stopped allowing dogs in the venue. Obviously we still support animals and any assistance dogs that they still come down. But outside of that, yeah, we don't allow dogs because of that.
So you disagree with this and you're trying to change it. Talk me through your reasoning.
Absolutely, I disagree with it. Dogs are part of the family nowadays. We've all just lived through COVID. Dog percentages, ownership percentages went up hugely, about 50%, I think, during COVID. Yeah, they're no longer just an animal that you leave in the backyard and occasionally pat and chuck some food out the back for them. They're now part of the family. My kids are madly in love with Archer. He used to come everywhere with me. They're just part of every day-to-day life now, as far as I'm concerned, and they should be treated so.
So you were able to bring him everywhere with you to work. Now you can't anymore. How has Archer gone with that?
He's a bit grumpy. He when I leave the house in the morning, he looks at me and he's like, "Hey, Dad, am I coming?" And you just like, "Sorry, mate, you gotta stay here." And yeah, off I go. So yeah, it's a bit. He gets a bit grumpy about it.
Well, also here with me is Giuseppe Carabetta, Associate Professor of Workplace Business Law at the University of Technology, Sydney. Giuseppe, I need to know your conflicts of interest up top, please. Do you have a dog or not?
Yeah, well, I'm a bit a bit like Stuart. I have a particular special dog, Monty, who's an assistance dog, and he sort of started his life at 10 weeks with my late mum in aged care. So it's kind of a tribute to her, but also because without, you know, too much information here, Tegan, but I suffer from grief issues. So.
Wow, Giuseppe, I didn't mean to put you on the spot there. Thank you for sharing that. Monty sounds really, really special. Well, so this is really, your work is really close to your heart. You've been looking at the lay of the land on dog-friendly workplaces. What are the laws in Australia?
Well, it's a bit like as with you know, a retailer or a restaurant or pub like Stuart. There's a discretion. So the general rule is no for a pet. So it is up to the proprietor. But also we have an obsession, healthy or otherwise, with food safety compliance in Australia. And so there are particular rules that we can get into, if you like a 10-metre rule in New South Wales. And, you know, if you don't have an outdoor area, you're going to have problems. But from there on, the owner of the establishment, it's up to them, and they can say yes or they can exclude pets. But with an assistance dog like Monty, he's exempt from all those restrictions. So I've taken him everywhere from Allianz Stadium to watch the Waratahs, right through to the Senate recently in Canberra. So, and he does, to address your question, he now comes to work, but with, you know, with some parameters.
Right. So assistance dogs, that's a special category. I think most people understand that. What are the sort of changing, well, are they changing the attitudes towards pet dogs in public places?
Yeah, I've had that question all week, Tegan and Stuart. Again, too much information, but I grew up in Italy where there's just a very different, it's a cultural issue really, and there's a history behind this. And part of it is that, you know, we're suburban, whereas, you know, in Italy, a place like Bologna, it's really dense. Mm. So the dogs are just there, right? So there's a really different attitude, and that's reflected in the laws. We have a review, as I understand, we have at the moment, and Stuart may be all over this, in New South Wales at least, there is a pending review, as I understand it, of our Act. But our Act at the moment, our Companions Act, I'm leaving aside now assistance dogs like Monty, it is pretty, you know, prohibitive. So everything from child play areas, which seems fair enough, to, you know, councils can signpost beaches, sports facilities, even shopping arcades, through to schools, childcare areas, which again, you know, that seems fairly reasonable. But the big one is the food preparation one. And to address your question again, I think we're starting to see a bit of a shift, and I live in an area which is dog positive and dog friendly, but, you know, still really in a transitional phase. And Stuart, I think, would subscribe to that.
Stuart, do you want to speak to that?
Yeah, like we recently, or about a year ago, drafted a template for an email that people who were supporting our petition they could go on and they could send it to the health minister. We got a reply from the health minister at the time, who it very much felt like was just blowing us off and just going, the response was something along the lines of, hey, thanks for your email, but we're not going to put into position a trial period for this law change. If you wish to change the law, you can apply for it yourself. Now, as a small business, we don't have a huge amount of money to throw at trying to change laws, and that's completely ridiculous for me to even dream about that. The health minister in his email suggested trying to apply for changing the law similar to Virgin Australia. Now, Virgin Australia are, as we most of us know, are a multinational company and have a fantastically large amount of backing behind them, so they can afford to go and challenge that and allow dogs onto planes. As for me, it seems like the most contradictory thing. You allow dogs onto planes in a small metal tube in a confined space where there is food prepared, but you won't allow dogs into my, you know, 550 square meter brewery with high ceilings and ventilation and all the rest of it. So it seems very contradictory to me.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Stuart Martin, who's the owner of Archer Brewing, a pub that started a community campaign to change the law to allow dogs in pubs, and Giuseppe Carabetta, Associate Professor of Workplace Business Law at UTS, looking into dog-friendly workplaces. Lots of texts on this. One person says, absolutely, allow dogs in public spaces. However, dogs have to be kept close to their owners. We have a beautiful dog who is well behaved until another dog comes up and bothers him for no reason, except poor dog ownership behaviours. Dogs are like kids. Keep them close and seek consent from adults before assuming they are okay to play with yours. Tom says, I love dogs, but people who have to take them to restaurants need to get a grip. Tom says, they're dogs, not people. It's basic hygiene. Stuart in Townsville says, I go to a cafe regularly on a Saturday that is designed for dogs as much as humans. Water bowls everywhere and dog food items on the menu. David says, my dog is a story dog. We go to a school and sit with a child while they read to us. Really broad spectrum there, Giuseppe. How does that fit with what you're hearing in your research?
Yeah, well, I really like, well, I think the second last texter was Stuart, was it, who mentioned it really comes down to an issue of design. And our guest, our pub owner, Stuart from Scotland, he's saying that, you know, he has things like ventilation in place. He has a big space and that kind of thing. So it's really, can you manage? And you had another texter who mentioned behavioural issues. So I see it as, and the research supports this, at least in the workplace, if you're going to have dogs in a workplace context, then it's going to work. So, excuse the pun, it's going to be effective in terms of social interaction and stress and that kind of thing. And, you know, you're accommodating people with allergies and you're accommodating people with phobias. Not easy to do, easy for me to talk about from my ivory tower as an academic, but, you know, if you can do it and you can do it on a reasonable sort of basis, then, you know, make a risk management case. So have signage up, keep your discretion, but have signage, train your staff in how to deal with hygiene procedures and that kind of thing and behavioural issues. Really make it conspicuous. So really alert the patrons to what's going on. You can have zones, you can have dog-free seating. So I've expanded it beyond the workplace, but coming back to my situation, they've said we had a complaint. So again, I empathise with Stuart. We had a complaint despite the fact that he's an assistance dog, you know, and he had his vest on and everything, and he's amazing, and everyone loves him. That's a bit of an issue because he's too social. But the complaint came through, and then I met with HR, and very reasonably, we set up some parameters. So they consulted me. Leaving aside the fact that I'm a workplace specialist, But it was a really constructive conversation, and it said things like, only I can handle him. He's not allowed near, you know, didn't set up a 10-meter rule or anything, but he's not allowed near a kitchenette. Fair enough again. No one else is allowed to handle him. He's got to have his vest on and, you know, some parameters around, you know, obviously I can't take him to a lecture theatre because he's too engaging and that kind of thing.
Stuart, what kind of balance do you think there needs to be between legal requirements and discretion on the part of you as a business owner or a dog owner who's seeing their dog as fit to bring out in public?
Really, that's all we're asking for, is the ability to choose. Now, discretion from a business owner. Now, if my business goes bankrupt because I allow dogs and people don't like dogs to come to the pub, that's on me and that's on my shoulders and I've got to explain that. But the discretion of the individual who owns the dog, the discretion of the staff, how many dogs, for example, how many dogs, you know, if 50 people turned up and they all had a dog, we're going to have an issue because you put that many dogs in a close confined space, you're going to have some issues. So my staff, most of them are dog owners. They are definitely all dog lovers and they work tirelessly. If there are dogs in the venue, assistance dogs, support dogs, then they ensure that the people sat around them are comfortable and have no issues. If any issues are raised, then they will help move the individual to another area. For example, we don't allow dogs upstairs on the mezzanine, so there is a dog-free area. Unfortunately, with the position of our building and our licensing and various things, we can't put an outdoor space. But that's really unfortunate. I would love to have outdoor space because we all live in Queensland and that's a beautiful part of the world where we love being outside. But that's what we're asking for, is the permission as a business owner to choose how I run my business. You know, small business is struggling hard right now. And to be able to take away, like I regularly see locals that used to come in all the time with a dog, stop for a pint, 2 pints. If their partner was away, they might have 3 pints and stay for some lunch or dinner and things like that. That's not to look at people in a monetary term, but as someone walks past the door that used to visit on a daily basis, that's money walking past the door. That's $15. That's $30 if it's 2 pints or whatever it is going past the door. And we all struggle. We all need every little bit of help we can get. And for me, we built this place with Archer in mind. And, you know, there's doors on the kitchens, there's doors on the bar, there's a fence around the brewery. It's not like dogs can just wander willy-nilly. And as dog owners, exactly as one of your texters said, it's about responsible ownership. If your dog is uncomfortable, has anxiety, whatever, you remove them from the situation. Same as my kids. If my kids are losing it in the pub, my kids come to the pub all the time, and some people believe that kids shouldn't be allowed in pubs. Like if you're from the UK, a lot the licensing laws in the UK about having children in pubs is very different to here in Australia. But if my kids are in the pub and they kick off for whatever reason, because I take a screen away from them or whatever it is, I remove them from the pub because that's responsible parenting. If they're stressed and people around them are stressed, it's never going to end well.
Responsible pet parenting too. Stuart, Giuseppe, thank you both so much for joining me today. Stuart Martin owns a brewery in Brisbane. He's just started a community campaign to allow his dog Archer back into the pub, named in his honour, and Giuseppe Carabetta is an Associate Professor of Workplace Business Law at the University of Technology, Sydney. Thank you for your sharing your ideas as well. Gigi says, I love dogs, but I think it's ridiculous that some sports ovals are also used for walking dogs. That dog's poo on a sporting field is revolting. Even if picked up, there's residual left behind waiting for someone to faceplant in it. Yuck. And Jay says, it's a complete absurdity that I can't travel by train if I want to take my dog with me. There's no good reason for this. On the contrary, there's good reasons to allow leashed dogs on trains. If, as you say, 50% of people have a dog, then the government's push for people to use public transport falls on the deaf ears of those 50%. Well, coming up next here on Life Matters, how do you give your kids advice about getting their first job when the workforce has completely changed since you got yours?
Are there any winners in the cost of living crisis? Has gambling become our national sport? How much more can our farmers survive? What's causing the algal bloom? Can we afford the energy transition?
Questions, they've never been more important. So the one thing we'll never question is our duty to keep asking. ABC News, keep asking.
Do you remember how you got your first ever job? Mine was at the local snack bar. I'm pretty sure my mum just talked them into hiring me. A few years later, I remember walking around the local shopping town with a sheaf of paper resumes trying to get a coveted retail job. And even beyond that high school job, the pathway used to be fairly straightforward. You'd study or train, you would apply for jobs in that field and work your way up the ladder. The problem is that pathway isn't so clear anymore. There are fewer entry-level jobs, industries are being impacted by AI, people are more likely to switch careers several times over their working lives. And if you've got kids entering the workforce, it can be hard to recognise that world that they're entering. So how do you give them advice? What do you say to a young person when really you're not sure what their next steps should be? You're about to hear from someone who has been thinking a lot about this. With me is Lisa Leong, host of This Working Life on ABC Radio National. She started joining me fortnightly to help you unpack how to make your work life better. I've been calling our chats Work in Progress. Lisa, do you remember the career advice you were getting from your parents as a teenager?
Yeah, so Dad was a sort of do as I do type of person, and he was really, really into his job as an architect. So I think the vibe I got from him was definitely choose a job that you love, but then work really hard at it. So he was always sketching and reading. And then the thing that really influenced me was a family friend who happened to be a lawyer, and I just fell in love with her and her career. And so I found this little picture I did in primary school, Tegan, and it was a little picture of me, and it said, you know, perfect career. And I wrote lawyer at the time. And then it said perfect car. I don't know why that was the second question. And I wrote Nissan Bluebird with electric windows.
Electric windows.
So that was my dream. It was like a school version of a vision board, I guess.
Okay, so that's the advice you got from your dad. What advice have you given as a parent?
It's a hard one, isn't it, Tegan? Because
it shouldn't be for you. You literally host a show called This Working Life.
Yeah, and I can find myself doing really crazy things. So there's part of me, and I think this is maybe a trap we fall into as parents, which is the, you know, I have all the answers person. And, you know, if you follow my career advice, this will, you know, put you in good stead. And then there's another part of me that knows that I'm, you know, I'm anxious about the fact that jobs are changing rapidly, casualisation of the workforce and all these things that we're thinking about, will my daughter ever leave home, that type of thing. And that part of me then sort of is floundering a little bit, because I know that by giving her advice in absolutes, that's actually not going to serve her well.
I think you do worry about your kids, and you're trying to channel as much information to them as you can. You're trying to set them up as best you can. And it's not a nice feeling to feel like you're not able to do that job. It sort of really plays into two things, like workplace anxiety and parental guilt.
Yeah. And interestingly, the parent influence is so great. So when you ask people, who gave you that career advice and what did you pay attention to? The role of parents are so great. So career advisors in schools, they don't just look at the children anymore or the students. They actually now try and engage with the parents, because the child will go home and no matter what has been discussed in the school, sometimes that parent influence is really, you know, playing a part in their next move. So I think that's really interesting to know that as a parent, you know, whatever you say and do, that is disproportionate really in terms of the crew that you need to help you with your career. And in fact, when I'm advising people on their careers, I actually get them to go back and say, like, you're actually supposed to be driving the car, but who have you let drive that career car? And are you just in the passenger seat? And when are you going to take over with the driving?
That's such a good analogy. I'm also interested to talk about what you see as the biggest changes in the workforce over the past few decades. What you think are the biggest differences between what you or I might have come into in our early careers versus what our kids are going into?
There's big changes. And I think one of those big mistakes that I talked about is that as a parent, you think about your experience when you're giving advice to a student these days. Times have changed. So World Economic Forum looks at the changes in jobs, and they do say that, yes, 90 million jobs are lost, but 120 million jobs are gained. So what that means, though, Tegan, is what roles you think exist, you know, when you do a survey and it says, oh, you're going to be a vet or a doctor. Well, the roles have changed, but we don't quite know what the new roles are. So that is one thing. The second is this casualisation of the workforce. So more people have insecure work. You don't get a job for life anymore. And even if you get a permanent job, well, that's up for grabs when we come to restructures. So that's the second difference as well. And then just this idea of we are changing jobs nearly on average every 2 years. In the 90s, it was unheard of to really think about changing jobs too rapidly. It looked really bad on your CV. Mm. Why can't you keep a job? But that's different now. It's like, great, you've got a lot of variety. What did you learn? So the expectations are really quite different, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And then when it comes to giving career advice, schools are even integrating some of these new tools, including AI.
Yeah, so they're finding not only is the career advisor using AI and learning more about AI, but interestingly, the student will come in and they would have used AI like ChatGPT to ask them for a career plan. And so what the career counsellor needs to do is to work with them on that career plan and to be conscious about those limitations of AI, like the hallucinations, you know, the work slop. So if you ask the wrong question or a leading question, then you are going to get the answer that you want. So unfortunately, you've got to be really careful when it comes to this because you could be set on a path and find yourself really stuck and wondering, oh, how did this happen? Because you asked the wrong question at the wrong time.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor chatting to Lisa Leong. You know her voice from This Working Life, but she joins me fortnightly for a segment that we call Work in Progress because there's not enough work puns out there. We're talking about giving advice to young people looking to get their start in the workplace. How do I give good advice to the young people in my life when we are so uncertain about what the future of work looks like?
I think the first trap is to give too much advice. So that idea of really listening and asking good questions, Tegan, to tease out, because at the very least, it's a question of helping someone determine, you know, who they are. And I know that's a big question. And in fact, one of our experts, Alana Kilmartin, who sort of went to about 300 high schools over Australia and New Zealand, when she was looking at jobs and the job market, she said, actually, it's the first 5 years, the casual jog market, J-O-G, where you don't sprint, you're actually learning. So when you're a parent and you're asking those questions, you've got all this data from watching your child grow up and seeing when they're playing, when they're in flow. And so you can have a conversation about, I noticed that you are always ... doing this activity. What do you love about it? What do you find when you're doing it? And then they're the little either red threads, some people call it, or interesting things that you use as data, Tegan, to help them with that first 5 years of exploration. So you don't need to lock in, and you probably can't. Flexibility in careers or career elasticity, that's the main aim, I think, in longevity in your career, and to know that you're going to be moving around a lot and you're always going to be learning. So how do you foster that learning in your child as a parent?
A text from Andrew says, timeless job advice, be polite, respectful, honest, and communicate. Say please and thank you. Being polite goes a remarkably long way. Andrew says, I continue to get work that other people don't just through basic courtesy. When I'm delayed, I let people know who are expecting me to know. Gets a lot of understanding. How would you grade that text, Lisa?
Oh, I love all this. And it just reminds me, Tegan, that it's the human skills, isn't it? Is to realise, yes, you're human, and that these skills are super essential. Don't forget them. So we heard about the human skills of, well, respect, communication, keeping people in the loop, being reliable, creative problem solving, collaboration. We will always be working with others, you know, humans. So we need people skills and we need to respect each other. And I think this is essential. And if you can cultivate that in your young one, then yes, of course, all of these hygiene things, I guess they're called in jobs, this is actually going to help them really stand out, because sometimes it can be a bit lacking. We can forget that you can't just rely on the technology to do the people skills.
Well, Lisa, thank you as always. Lisa Leong joins me from This Working Life every fortnight. This Working Life explores the world of work. You can find every episode of it on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. And thank you so much for your text this morning. On giving good career advice to kids, even though the workforce has changed so much, one text says, I always taught my work experience kids to call ahead to site to see if there was anything they could pick up on the way in. Genius. We also spoke early in the show about what makes a good day. I asked you what you add to your day to make an average day a good day. One says, my perfect day is never planned. It's highly dependent on my state of mind. Susanna says, I aim to do 3 meaningful activities each day. An activity could be large or small, a walk in the park, a meeting, a class, home organisation or whatever, as long as it is fruitful and meaningful. Jeff says, at 68, a great day for me revolves around my addictions. Good coffee in the morning, swimming, running or riding, 3-hour ride yesterday, alcohol in the evening, beer while preparing dinner and a wine with dinner. But you do need a good sleep first. Sometimes I'll even have a snooze in the Arvo. And on dogs in public places, really mixed response from you this morning. Craig says, if an eating establishment is set up to cater for people with pets and it is explicit about that offer, that's all fine, but it's not a place I would be eating at myself. Carol says, yes, yes, yes to dogs in the pub and everywhere else. Why should they be left at home alone and bored stupid? My dog is no longer living, but I love going to places where I can get some doggy love. My rule was, if she can't go, then I don't go. Well, that is just about it for Life Matters. I've come to you today from Jagera and Turrbal Land. Tomorrow, I'll be back again, and we're going to talk about taking the renewable energy transition into your own hands. I'd love to know if there's any parts of your life that you have managed to somehow off-grid. Plus, food processing and a century of shifting advice to parents have turned today's kids into picky eaters, but they don't have to be. That's according to the author of a new book I'll be chatting to tomorrow. And the changing face of politeness. And who decides what polite means anyway? That is tomorrow on Life Matters. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'll catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.